Okay. So hello everyone. This presentation is about OpenCSD, which is a computational storage emulation platform. And the reason we're emulating that, I'll get into shortly. But first, I think I owe you an explanation of computational storage and what it actually is, because I don't think many people are familiar with that, even in this dev room. But I'm pretty sure most people are familiar with CAMU and eBPF. You can email me. There's a link to the repo. And this has been a long-time collaboration with my master's thesis at the FU. So let's get started. I'm going to briefly explain who am I. I'm Corné Lucke. My handle online is mostly Dentalion. I'm also a licensed ham radio operator, Papa Delta 3 Sierra Uniform, that is. And my expertise is in parallel and distributed system. I've been in academia for some while, associate degree, bachelor degree, master's degree. And I've had some experiences throughout that time. So I've worked on health technology for visually impaired people, worked on OpenStack with cloud optimizations. I've done computational storage for my master thesis. That's what this talk is about. And currently work on SCADA systems for the LOVER 2 radio telescope at Astron. So why do we actually need computational storage? And that's because we live in a data-driven society nowadays. So the world is practically exploding with data, so much so that we're expected to store 200 zettabytes of data by 2050. And these high data and throughput requirements pose significant challenges on storage interfaces and technologies that we are using today. So if you look at your traditional computer architecture, the one that's being used on x86, it's based on the von Neumann architecture. And here, we basically need to move all data into main system memory before we can begin processing. So this poses memory bottlenecks and interconnect bottlenecks on networks or PCI Express. And it also drastically it hinders energy efficiency to an extent. So how much of a bandwidth gap are we talking here? Well, if you look at the server from 2021, say using Epic Milan with 64 SSDs, we're losing about 4.5 times the amount of bandwidth that could be offered by all the SSDs in tandem, but can't be utilized because we can't move it into memory that fast. So that's quite significant. And what is this computational storage, and how does this solve this, actually? Well, we fit a computational storage device, so a flash storage device, with its own CPU and memory. And now the user, the host processor, can submit small programs to this computational device, let it execute, and only the result data from this computation can then be returned over the interconnect into system memory, thereby reducing data movement and potentially improving energy efficiency. Because these lower power cores using more specialized hardware are typically more energy efficient than your general purpose x86 processor. If we then look at the state of current prototypes as of September 2022, we see three main impediments. Firstly is the API between the host and device interface. There's no standardization here. People are building hardware prototypes, but not so much looking at the software interfaces. And we also have the problem of a file system, because these flash devices, they have file systems, and we want to keep that synchronized between the host and device. So how do we achieve that? We can't use cache-coherent interconnects or shared virtual memory, because by the time we back round-trip between the PCI Express interface, we'll have lost all the performance that we desire to gain. And how do we stick to existing interfaces? People that access file systems, they read, they write, they use system calls. They are very used to this. If you would suddenly need to link a shared library to access your file system, people wouldn't be up for that. So we need some solutions here. That's what OpenCSD and FluffLFS introduce. We have a simple and intuitive system. All the dependencies and the software itself can run in user space. You don't need any kernel modules or things like this. We manage to entirely reuse existing system calls that are available in all operating systems, most typical operating systems, FreeBSD, Windows, macOS, and Linux. So I'd say that's pretty good. And we do something that's never been done before in computational storage. We allow a regular user on the host to access a file concurrently while a kernel that is executing on the computational storage device is also accessing that file. And this has never been done before. And we managed to do this using existing open source libraries. So we've Boost, Xenium, Fuse, UBPF, and SPDK. Some of you will be familiar with some of these. And this allows any user like you to, after this talk, try and experience this yourself in CAMU without buying any additional hardware. And I'll get into that hardware in a second, because there's some specialized hardware that if we want to have this physically in our hands, we have to do some things. And if we look at the design, then we see four key components and a fifth one that I'll explain on the next slide. We're using a lock structured file system, which supports no in-place updates, so everything is appended and appended. And we have a module interface where we have backends and frontends, so this allows us to experiment and try out new things. We can basically swap the backends and keep the frontend the same. And we're using this new technology in flash SSDs that's called zone namespaces. They are commercially available now, but they're pretty hard to get still, but that's going to improve in the future. And the existing system calls that we managed to reuse, those are extended attributes. So extended attributes on any file and directory on most file systems, on the file system you are using likely now, you can set arbitrary key value pairs on these files. And we can use this as a hint from the user to the file system to instruct the file system that something special needs to happen. And basically we just reserve some keys there and assign special behavior to them. Now let's get back to the topic of zoned namespaces, because I owe you some explanation here. Back when we had hard drives, we could perform arbitrary reads and writes to arbitrary sectors. Sectors could be rewritten all the time without any without requiring any erasure beforehand. This is what is known as the traditional block interface. But there's a problem, and that is that NAND flash doesn't actually support this behavior. So when you have NAND flash, your sectors are concentrated in blocks. And this block needs to be linearly written. And before you can rewrite the information in a block, the block needs to be erased as a whole. So in order to accommodate, flash SSDs have to incorporate what is known as a flash translation layer, where basically all these requests that go to the same sectors are somehow translated and put somewhere else physically, just so that the user can still use this same block interface that they have been used to from the time of hard drives. So there's this physical translation between these logical and physical blocks, and when we try to synchronize the file system from the host with the device while a kernel is running, this introduces a whole lot of problems. So how do we solve this? Now, you know the answer, it's the zoned namespaces. We basically present an interface that's not the block interface, and it's an interface that fits to the NAND flash behavior. So when you use the zoned namespaces SSD, you need, as a developer of a file system or the kernel, need to linearly write each sector in the block, and you need to erase the block as a whole. So effectively, you become the manager of this SSD. The flash translation layer and the garbage collection lives on the host, and we call this whole system host managed. If we now combine this with a lock structured file system, which also didn't have any in-place updates, and then you naturally see that this becomes a very good fit. And now, together with these two technologies, we can finally synchronize the host and the file system. And we can do that by making the file temporarily immutable while the kernel is running. And we do that using a snapshot consistency model by creating in-memory snapshots. So we were able to create a representation of the file as it was on the host with metadata, put that to the computational storage device memory, and we can assure that all the data that is there will remain immutable during the execution of the kernel. Meanwhile, the user can actually still write to the file, and the metadata of the file on the host will differ, but that's not a problem. So this is very powerful, and it allows us to also understand kernel behavior in a way, because we can now have metadata and send it to the computational storage device that says, well, actually, if the kernel tries to do this, remember, it's a user-submitted program, it might be malicious, then we want to block those actions. So we have a security interface as well. The final kick in the bucket for this design is that we want to be architecture independent, and we do that through eBPF, the system that you're also using for network hooks and event hooks in the Linux kernel nowadays. With eBPF, you can define system calls and expose those in a header, and this is actually the format of how you would do that. That's a real example. And then the vendor would implement that code, and you would define in a specification some behavior but the vendor doesn't have to open source their code, which in the case of flash SSDs and vendors is pretty important because they don't seem to be that keen on that. And this way we can still have an interface that users can write programs once and reuse them across all vendors without any problem. And the nice thing about eBPF is that this instruction set architecture, what eBPF essentially is easily implementable in a VM. So there's even pre-existing open source implementations of this, and that's what we're using, uBPF. Now that I've explained all the key components to OpenCSD and FlowFLFS, I want to start with a little demo and show you what are some of the actual practical use cases for this. So how can we use such a computational storage system in a way that it makes sense in terms of data reduction and energy efficiency? And for that, we're going to go to the example of Shannon Entropy. This is heavily used by file systems who can perform background compression or by just compression programs that compress in the background. What you basically do is you try to quantify the randomness you have in a file. Typically, it's between 0 and 1, but for computers, that doesn't really make sense. So we use this log B that's over here to normalize this for bytes. Then we can say, what's the distribution of bytes? So we create, because a byte has 265 different possible values, we create 265 bins, and we submit a program to calculate this. It runs in the background, and only the result is returned to the host operating system. And then the host operating system is free to decide whether or not this file should be compressed or not. So how does such a kernel look like, the kernel that you actually submit to the computational storage device? Well, you can just write them in C and compile them with Clang. So you write them in C, and we have two individual interfaces here that we are exposing. The yellow commands, those are introduced by the system calls, the eBPF ABI that we are defining. And the purple ones, those are introduced by a file system. What that means is that using this system as is now, that it's not agnostic to the file system. So it is agnostic to the vendor and the architecture of the vendor. If it's ARM or x86, that doesn't matter. But now it's specific to the FlowFLFS file system that we have written. And I will address some possible solutions for this at the end. Other things we need to realize is that the eBPF stack size is typically very small. We're talking bytes here instead of kilobytes. So we need a way to address this. So what you can do is in uBPF, you can allocate a heap just as your stack. And then we have this BPF get mem info that we have defined as part of the ABI that allows you to get your heap pointer. Now, currently you have to manually offset this, which is a bit tedious, if you will. You see that is actually done here. To store the bins, we offset the buffer by the sector size, and then the data from the sector reads is actually stored at the top of the buffer, and the bins are stored at the offset for precisely one sector size. Now, when we go to look at the file system interface and all the helpers and data structures and additional function calls that we introduce, we can later see that we can also make a basic implementation of malloc and free here and then just resolve this. But for now, for this example, it's a bit tedious. Now, how do you actually trigger this? So we had the extended attributes, we had all these systems in place, but now you just have this kernel, you have compiled it, and you've stored it to a file, and now you want to actually offload your computation, well, in an emulated fashion, but you want to see how you do that. So the first thing you do is you call start on the kernel object. So this is your compiled bytecode. And then you get the inode number. This inode number you have then to remember, and you then open the file that you want to read upon, or write upon, but for the examples we're using read mostly. Then you use set extended attribute, you use our reserved key, and you set it to the inode number of the kernel file, and then when you actually issue read commands, the read commands will actually go to the computational storage device, and they'll run on there. But when do you actually take these snapshots? And the trick is as soon as you set extended attributes. This is just by design, right? It could also be once you call the first read or once you execute the first write. But we have decided to do it at the moment that you set extended attribute. That means that if you make any changes to your kernel once you've actually set extended attribute, then nothing changes anymore. And the same goes to the file. Now, I want to briefly explain some different types of kernel that you can have. And what the example here is mainly showing is what we call a stream kernel. So a stream kernel happens in place of the regular read or write request. So the regular read or write request doesn't happen. Only the computational storage request happens on the computational storage device. And with an event kernel, it's like the opposite way around. First, the regular event happens normally, and then the kernel is presented with the metadata from that request and can do additional things. This is, for databases, interesting. For example, say you're writing a big table, and you want to know the average or the minimum or the maximum, and you want to emit that as metadata at the end of your table write. Well, you could use an event kernel to let it write as is. Then you get presented with the data, the kernel runs on the computational storage device, and you emit the metadata after, and you can store it as like an index. We have also decided to isolate the context of this computational storage offloading, so what is considered once you set attribute by PID. But we also could make this by file handle, or you could even set it for the whole inode. More so, we could use specific keys for file handle, PID, or inode offloading. So it's just a matter of semantics here. Now, I have some source code in Python of this execution steps that I've just shown here, because there's a little bit of details that I left out in the brief overview. The first is that you have to stride your requests, and those have to be strided by 512k. And why is this so? Well, infuse the amount of kernel pages that are allocated to move data between the kernel and the user space is statically fixed. So if you go over this, then your request will seem fine from the user perspective, but what the kernel will do is it will chop up your requests. Why is that problematic? Well, then multiple kernels spawn, because from the context of the file system, every time it sees a read or write request, it's going to spawn this kernel and move it to the computational storage device. Then here you can see how I set the extended attribute and get the kernel, the inode number. And what I want to show here at the bottom is that I'm getting 265 integers, and that's for each of the buckets of the entropy read, but I'm having a request of 512k. So that shows you the amount of data reduction that you can achieve using systems like this. 265 integers, 512k, pretty good. Could be better though. The reason it's not better is floating point support in eBPF is limited to the fact where you need to implement fixed point match yourself. So we could do this as part of the file system helpers, but that's not done for this prototype at the moment. Now, some limitations. This was a master thesis work. This was my first time defining a file system ever. It's solely a proof of concept. There's no garbage collection, no deletion, no space reclaiming. Please don't use it. Please don't use it to store your files. Yeah. eBPF has an endianness, just like any ISA would have. And there's currently no conversions. So if you happen to use something that uses different endianness, all your data will be upside down. So that's you have to deal with that yourself for now. But once again, we can make it part of the file system helpers to help with these data structure layout conversions and the endianness conversions. As I mentioned briefly earlier, floating point support in eBPF is practically non-existent, but we can implement fixed point math. And currently, I haven't shown any performance examples because I don't think that they are that interesting. Because what's currently happening when you emulate offloading is that it just runs on the host processor as is in eBPF. So it isn't representative of the microcontrollers that you would find on SSDs.